Third case for today, 12AP2140 CR State versus Angelica C. Nelson. Arguing on behalf of Ms. Nelson is Assistant State Public Defender Michelle L. Velasquez.
May it please the Court, my name is Michelle Velasquez, and I represent Ms. Nelson. During trial, after the state rested, Ms. Nelson confirmed that she understood her rights as they pertain to testifying. She also confirmed that she had spoken about those rights with her attorney. When the court asked what her decision was, she was clear. I want to testify. The court should have stopped the colloquy there and allowed Ms. Nelson to get on the stand and testify. Instead, the court continued to question both Ms. Nelson and her attorney about what the substance of the testimony would be, the decision, and what counsel's advice regarding the decision was.
Counsel, I see this as a little bit of a tricky issue, so I want to lay this out there so that we can try to sort through this as we go through the case. When I would talk to someone about whether or not they wish to testify in their case, we'd have a colloquy, and there are some special materials on that, I think at 28 and 29, and try to go through and say, you know, you understand you have the right to testify. It's also your absolute right not to testify. No one can force you to testify. And then go through whether or not anyone tried to influence that decision. They've had ample opportunity to discuss that with their lawyer, and so on and so forth. And then the court's required to make a finding, I think, as to whether the person is knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily making their decision. Because it's their decision alone, really. And I get that you're saying that she said she wanted to testify. Part of when I read the record, though, I thought, what would I have done as the trial court judge? Because it doesn't seem clear to me that she really understood that she would be absolutely admitting the relevant elements of this offense if she testified. I mean, to me, it's almost that she'd be doing herself in if she testified, and that it wasn't necessarily clear that she understood the implications of testifying. That's difficult for me, because had the court said, oh, yeah, just go ahead and testify, and then she admits the crime, admits the elements, admits everything that there is to convict her, then you'd be in maybe a good position to argue that the court shouldn't have found that she knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily made her decision regarding testimonial privilege.
If I understand your question correctly.
Question, but it's something that when I read this, I thought, gosh, I don't know what I would do as a judge. I'm a little bit stuck because, sure, she said she wanted to testify, but whether she really understood what she was doing is sort of an issue that sticks in the back of my mind.
Am I correct that the concern then is that if the defendant's testimony is detrimental to their case, that may be something that shows that their decision is not knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. Is that the court's concern?
It didn't seem clear to me in this record that she knew what she was doing.
I think the record in this case is clear that she understood her rights. The threshold for whether or not a defendant understands his or her right to testify is not whether their testimony is necessarily favorable. It may, in fact, be to their detriment. That, however, does not diminish the defendant's ability to make a decision, their own decision, and have that decision honored. Ms. Nelson was clear and unambiguous that she wanted to testify. She told the court she understood that she had a right not to. She confirmed that she had spoken about the pros and cons of testifying and that testifying would mean the state would be allowed to cross-examine her. She told the trial court that she understood two of the elements that the state would need to prove in her case. Nonetheless, she still wanted to testify.
Counselor, I think that when you talk about testify, it in a way sanitizes what was going to happen here, because she was going to incriminate herself. And is there really anything you can point to in the record that she knew by testifying she was going to incriminate herself in this crime in the middle of the trial?
Ms. Nelson did state that she would not deny that she had sexual relations with the complainant. However, she also stated that she did not agree with the time frame in which these events were alleged to have occurred. That's significant because the state charged Ms. Nelson with three separate acts occurring on three separate dates. That testimony was, of course, never developed because she was unable or prohibited from taking the stand, but that may have been testimony that would have ultimately shown innocence in perhaps at least one of the occasions that she was accused of.
I thought she didn't deny having sexual relations with this boy. I didn't understand that.
She didn't deny having sexual relations with him, but there are two points I think that the record in the extended colloquy that the court engaged in that demonstrate perhaps she would have had testimony contrary to the testimony from the complainant, from the complainant's mother and the officer, namely that she refuted the dates in which these events were alleged to have occurred. She also indicated
she wouldn't have been under 17 years of age on any of the dates, correct?
I don't believe so.
I mean, if she had been, it would make quite a big difference. But
correct. I don't know what other date, if any, she would say it occurred, because, again, we didn't hear her testimony. See, we don't have that. What the record does show is that she was not agreeing that the three incidents occurred on the three dates as alleged in the complaint. She also indicated, or her defense counsel indicated to the court, that she wanted to testify about the fact that she had not been the one to unbuckle the complainant's pants on one of the occasions. The court dismissed that as insignificant. However, I believe that was error, because one of the jury instructions was that not that Ms. Nelson just had sexual relations with the complainant, but that in order to find her guilty, and this is in the record, citation 45, page 135, with respect to the act of sexual intercourse, Angelica Nelson must have instructed or directed the complainant to perform an act of sexual intercourse upon her, or must have allowed it, that is, consciously and affirmatively consented to the complainant performing an act of sexual intercourse on her. So it wasn't just the fact that the complainant was underage and that they had sexual relations. There was something more that the state had to prove. And Ms. Nelson's testimony would have gone directly to those two things, the dates and perhaps who instructed who or who consented. And that testimony was erroneously
but
barred.
But the date, counsel, goes only to the defendant's benefit. The date needs to be specific enough for the defendant to understand the approximate date upon which the events that lead to the charge are alleged to have occurred, so that she may participate in her defense. And as to, you know, who unbuckled the belt buckle, I see nothing in the record to indicate any allegation of non-consensual sexual contact. So I don't know what inference you would like us to draw. It goes back to Justice Rogensack's question, which was premised on the idea that anything she was going to say was not going to refute the elements, and Justice Ziegler started the questioning on this line, too, but was only going to bolster the state's case. I mean, I guess as far as the dates and the belt buckle, I guess my question is, and I don't mean this sarcastically, and I'll phrase it a different way. What would you like us to do with that information? So what? So the dates might have been a little different, and the belt buckle, he might have unbuckled his own belt. Please.
Those details are important because they go directly to the crimes as charged as well as a jury instruction.
How do they go directly to the crimes charge?
The state charged her with three separate acts occurring on May 8th, 9th, and 10th. Now, what, if any other date, Ms. Nelson would have stated something happened or didn't happen, we don't know. And that's the problem in this case, is that her entire defense is missing. She was the only witness for herself, and she was essentially foreclosed from presenting any defense because the circuit court determined that she wasn't making this decision voluntarily because she may have something to say detrimental to herself. That's not the test about whether or not a person
can
testify. I
agree with that. I totally agree with that, that's not the test. I'm still trying to determine whether the trial court made an error when he decided she did not knowingly and intelligently waive her right to silence and thereby incriminate herself in the crimes for which she was charged. That's what I'm trying to look at. Was the trial court wrong when he determined that she didn't understand what she was going to be doing? I mean, anybody could understand standing up on a witness stand and saying what you want to say and giving your side of the story. That's what I took away from the colloquy. She wanted to give her side of the story. But her side of the story wasn't a denial of any of the three acts of sexual intercourse. And so I'm trying to figure out, was the trial court wrong in determining she didn't know? She didn't intelligently decide to incriminate herself.
The trial court was wrong because the trial court's colloquy should have ended when it had the discussion with Ms. Nelson and her attorney that the pros and cons of testifying, the implications of testifying, those had been discussed between Ms. Nelson and her attorney. And this court in Denson declined to extend a colloquy requirement.
Right.
When a defendant chooses to testify. And the reasons this court gave for not extending the requirement of a colloquy was because requiring a trial court to do that runs the risk of a judge interfering with that relationship between the defendant and her attorney. It runs the risk of the court inadvertently discouraging a defendant from testifying. So those are the risks that this court identified.
Counsel, you're certainly touching on some of the things that are of concern to me, but one of the things I want you to hit directly is why this error, assuming there was error here, why this error was a structural error so that harmless error does not apply. That is your position, right?
Yes, it is our position that this error is structural. The right to testify is personal to the defendant. It is fundamental to the adversarial system. And the right to present a defense, the right to self-representation, are incomplete unless the defendant is afforded the right to speak on his or her behalf to his or her jury. The jury is that of the defendant. It is a jury of her peers to decide her fate. The only case that I'm aware of directly on point with this issue is State versus Rivera, and that's from South Carolina. There, the South Carolina Supreme Court held that when a trial court makes a wholesale denial of the right to testify, that is not amenable to harmless error. That is structural. In that case, the defendant, like Ms. Nelson, was unambiguous and continuously maintained that he wanted to testify. yet the trial court determined that his testimony would not be relevant and declined to allow him to take the stand. That's the exact set of facts we have in this case. And there the South Carolina Supreme Court said that the right to testify transcends a mere evidentiary ruling or a presentation of evidence, that there's something more profound about a defendant's right to get up on the stand and face their accusers than just the presentation of evidence. Now, the cases that the state cites don't deal with this exact set of facts. The cases that the state cites primarily deal with ineffective assistance of counsel claims or situations where a defendant has already waived his right to testify and then at a later stage comes back, whether it be within minutes or the next day, but has already waived their right on the record and then comes back and asks the court to allow him to revoke that waiver. That's not what we have here. In this case, again, Ms. Nelson was clear. I just want my side to be heard. I want to tell what actually happened. Her right to testify is not based on whether she has something exculpatory to say.
That's my question. I made the assumption in reading this that what she was going to say was not going to dispute the elements of the crime. In that what she was going to say was, she said she was going to say. She was going to tell what happened. And from what my reading was, she was going to tell that there was intercourse on three separate occasions. It might have been not in the exact same date set forth, but three occasions as charged. And so my question is, let's just suppose, I'm going to start back. You are trying to make the case that what she might say might be a defense to one or more of the charges. Is that the,
That's
you're
correct.
Trying to say that? Okay. Let's assume it would not. Let's assume that she was not going to say anything that was going to deny or in any manner set up a defense for the three charges. She was going to admit it, that the intercourse happened, that they were of the particular age, but she was going to say things like, he wanted it as much as I did, blah, blah, etc., and matters that would go to sentencing. Apparently, there's some issue about her competence, right? She asked for a competency hearing. It wasn't granted.
That's correct. A few days before trial.
Right. And so let's just assume she wasn't going to say anything that was going to be an adequate defense on the elements. And what she was going to say is not relevant to any of the elements. Okay? And suppose she took the stand, and after she stated her name and address, et cetera, every question asked, there would be an objection on relevance, which would be sustained. Right? Would you be here today? Because
yes.
She didn't say anything. Yeah. Why?
Yes, because the right to testify, again, is not incumbent on the defendant having something necessarily favorable to say. The court cannot preemptively prevent her from testifying because it doesn't believe she's doing so in her own favor, or that she'll say something that will be fatal to her case. The court should never have engaged in questioning about the substance of her testimony in the first place. I'm not saying that there aren't limitations and that there may come a point after she's on the stand where the court ends the questioning, because now we're just, there's every question is an objection or every answer is a sustained objection, and it's not relevant. But those are objections for the state to make, not for the court to preemptively determine for the defendant. I mean, in essence, this court took away her decision.
Could I ask, can you think of any situation in which the circuit court would have been proper to deny the defendant the right to testify if there had been the appropriate colloquy ahead of time?
I suppose if there had been the appropriate colloquy and throughout the colloquy simply asking the questions about what the defendant understands about his or her right to testify and whether they had talked to counsel, if it became clear that the individual didn't know what it meant to testify or hadn't had that discussion with counsel, perhaps in that scenario a trial court could make a finding that it can't conclude that the decision to testify is being made knowingly and intelligently. But in this case, there was no doubt that Ms. Nelson spoke with her attorney. In fact, she spoke with her attorney there on the record as well. The court did ask a few questions and explain what her rights were. 4 days, I think it's worth noting, 4 days before trial, defense counsel raised competency, and the trial court said that it found absolutely no reason to question her competence to stand trial. I think that given that fact, the court had said no reason to question whether or not she understood her right to testify. If she's competent to stand trial, I think she's competent to make the decision about whether or not to testify. Now, whether that's against the advice of her attorney, again, is not relevant. Her attorney noted that during this extended colloquy that she had talked to her about the right. It wasn't her advice, but she said it's her decision nonetheless. I've explained the pros and cons, and her attorney, rightfully so, was prepared to go forward with her client getting up on the stand and testifying, again, because her client wasn't allowed to. Defense counsel couldn't even make a closing argument, showing again that this wasn't, if this court finds that this is an structural error, which I maintain that it is structural, it's certainly not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt when any presentation of a defense is completely foreclosed because of the trial court's error.
May I ask this? A defendant has a constitutional right to defend herself at trial.
Correct.
A defendant might even dismiss a public defender. Yeah, unimagined. But a defendant has a right to defend herself at trial. But that right isn't always vindicated by the circuit court. Or sometimes the court says, no, I don't think this is right. How do you distinguish that from the insistence of the right of the defendant to testify?
The circuit court certainly does need to make a finding that she's making this decision knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily. But there's nothing in this record that indicates that she didn't understand her rights. And I think that would be the scenario when perhaps a trial court would not allow a defendant to represent him or herself, which that is structural error if that's done erroneously. This type of right was described by the United States Supreme Court as being even more fundamental than that right to represent oneself. And this court explained in Denson that the colloquy was not going to be a requirement, recommended, but not a requirement, to try and avoid this type of scenario where the court engages in gathering information beyond what is necessary to make that determination of the client's ability to make that decision. I think the error occurred when Ms. Nelson said, I want to testify, and she had already discussed what that right meant, the pros and cons with her attorney. It was at that point that the court erred by going beyond what was necessary to make that determination.
Did the court have any motive other than to try to protect the interests of the defendant?
It may well have been the trial court's motive, to try and protect the defendant, But again, that's not the circuit court's duty. No matter how well-intentioned the court is, it was improper for it to question Ms. Nelson about the substance of her testimony and really question her decision. It's not for the court to question the wisdom of the defendant's decision. That's something that would have been discussed between Ms. Nelson and her attorney. We know from the record that her attorney was against testifying, but again, correctly said, this is my client's decision, and I have to honor that. I see that my red light is on, so is there any...
Well, let's see if you have any further questions. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General Aaron R. O'Neill, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Aaron O'Neill, Assistant Attorney General, appearing for the state of Wisconsin, which is the respondent in this matter. The state is asking this Court to conclude that any violation of the defendant's right to testify was harmless error. The state believes that, analytically, it will be more straightforward for this Court to decide this case, as the Court of Appeals did, on the harmless error issue, rather than trying to resolve the more difficult issue of whether the trial court's decision not to allow the defendant to testify violated her right to testify.
Should I take by a absence of argument on error in your brief that the state is conceding that there was error done here?
We're not conceding error. We are saying I don't know that there was error here. I think it's a very difficult decision issue for this court to resolve. I think when you look at the record of the colloquy and you see the defendant saying, I understand my rights, I want to testify, in one sense you say, well, okay, that's all that's required. But on the other hand, I also read the colloquy and I see the trial court deciding, I'm not finding she's not validly waiving her privilege against self-incrimination. And I think we, on one hand, we have to defer to that because, as Justice Ziegler said, what was the court supposed to do? All we have in this case that we're looking at is a cold record that has the defendant's answers as she said them, but the trial court was in a much different position than we are, and the trial court was observing the defendant and able to assess whether she really understood what she was doing and whether she understood her rights and her decision to take the stand.
You could be making an argument that there was no error because she's only entitled to testify to things that are material, and the trial court said not material here. I mean, what she's saying isn't material to the elements of the offense.
That's correct.
But you're not making that.
We're not making that argument. I think because, again, I think the state's position is it's not really clear what she would have testified to was relevant to the elements of the offense. On one hand, she was challenging some of the victim's testimony about the details of the assaults, which could go to his credibility, which would obviously be relevant. But on the other hand, if she's not going to deny that she committed these crimes, that it's really unclear whether the relevance of that, what that relevance of that testimony is. To suggest, for example, that she wanted to deny she unbuckled his belt, and rather he was the one who did it, she's almost suggesting, well, making an argument almost towards jury nullification, saying, well, we were both consenting to do this.
It's your position, even if her testimony was going to go to the elements of the offense, and it's unclear, but even if it is, the error here is harmless.
Yeah.
Is that your position?
Our position is that her testimony, from what we know from the colloquy, probably wouldn't have gone to the elements of the offense. It probably would have been more of a challenge to the credibility of the victim, which plays out in a different way, I think. But, yeah, even if it went to the elements, it would be harmless because she essentially was going to concede the elements when she testified.
If she couldn't understand so that she could not make a knowing, intelligent, voluntary decision, how can she stand trial? How can she help her own defense if she can't make that elementary decision?
There is a difference between competency to stand trial and a competency to waive a constitutional right.
What's the difference?
The competency to stand trial is you have to be understand the court procedures and be able to assist your counsel. The competency to, if a defendant's not competent, the court proceedings have to stop. Defendants are called upon to make waivers of their constitutional rights during trial. If the defendant's unable to exercise a right, that is a different matter.
Right. Well, it's understanding the right.
Right.
And she's bucking her client here, bucking her attorney here, right? Because he
right.
says, I've told her, I don't think she should testify. Right?
Yes.
I think it's awfully close here.
To that she's not competent to stand trial?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's just, unfortunately, we don't have a record that would really allow us to reach that conclusion. There was no competency.
That's right. Well, the judge turned that down.
That's correct.
But then he says she's not able to make a rational decision in the judge's viewpoint as to whether to testify.
The judge found that she wasn't understanding her right not to incriminate herself. I think that is a different issue than competency standards.
Could I ask if the judge had permitted her to testify, how would that have worked out? Would defense counsel have kept asking individual questions? Or, I mean, would it have been narrative? Or how would that have worked?
Judging from the colloquy, which, again, is all we have really to gauge what would have happened had the defendant testified, I think defense counsel would have questioned her about the topics that she wanted to talk about, which has included the dates, the unbuckling of the pants, and some other things, and whether they had discussed how old each other was. There may have been some relevancy objections from the state. I think at least a couple of those things. But I don't think it would have been a narrative because I don't think there's any indication she was going to perjure herself. And as I understand the law, that's the only way a narrative format is allowed.
I thought the judge asked defense counsel whether he was willing to question her. He said yes, he would. But I can't find it again.
Okay. I am not recalling that from the record.
Whenever we have a structural versus harmless error issue, I always go back to Arizona versus Fulamonte. I know that there are more recent renditions, but that, to me, this is a comfortable, good case. And I like it because it sets out the law as of 1991 regarding the difference between the structural error and the trial error, as they call it. And gives a laundry list. And so I always like, that's what I go to the case for. And one of the things in the trial error laundry list is, that is, when I say trial error, I mean it's subject to harmless error, is an erroneous exclusion of defendant's testimony regarding the circumstances of his confession, citing Delaware versus Van Arnstel. So I know that the United States Supreme Court has said that it is harmless error or subject to the harmless error test when considering whether there's an erroneous exclusion of defendant's testimony regarding the circumstances of his confession. But that may be very different than the total exclusion of testimony. So tell me why the total exclusion of testimony is not structural, given the other things you've said in your brief about how it's the right to testify is a fundamental right. But, of course, fundamental rights can't be subject to harmless error.
Correct.
A error that involved the partial exclusion of testimony in the case I cited, is subject to harmless error. What about the total exclusion of testimony?
The think going back to the test in Arizona versus Fulminante, and that's been adopted by this court, the, really the analysis is whether we can assess the effect of the error on the outcome of the trial. When it's excluding the defendant's testimony, we can look at what that testimony would have been and assess it in light of the other evidence.
I don't know. I don't know if I agree with you. That is the harmless error test. In fact, I liked the way that you set forth the harmless error test, and that is whether or not beyond you set it forth in the alternative, and so I liked the way that you did that. But the question to me is a threshold question. Before you get to how you define the harmless error test, is the harmless error test even applicable in this kind of a case? You don't get to the nice alternative exposition of the harmless error test that you put here in your brief until you make the threshold determination of if this is structural or harmless, I think. But tell me if you disagree with me.
Correct. Maybe I'm not understanding your question correctly, but the way for the method for determining whether an error is structural is, as the Supreme Court recently stated in Gonzalez-Lopez in footnote 4, is whether it can be assessed in light of the other evidence at trial and determine whether it's harmless. If it can't, then the error is structural. If it can, then the error is a trial error and subject to harmless error.
So go through that analysis then, applying that test.
Sure. In this case, we have a defendant who was not allowed to testify. And what that means is that the trier of fact was unable to hear certain evidence in her defense. That is, we can find out what that evidence is, and we can weigh it against the other evidence in the case and other factors that may bear on whether an error is harmless.
See, that's where I pause. You say certain evidence. And much like the Delaware case that I cited to as being harmless there, this is a total exclusion of evidence. And how does that fit in?
Well, I think, again, if you look at other constitutional rights that are subject to harmless error that involve, the exclusion of evidence on a defendant's behalf, for example, a violation of the right to confrontation, the denial of a right to compulsory process, denial of the right to present favorable witnesses on the defendant's behalf, those are all subject to harmless error analysis, and that can include the absolute deprivation, for example, of a piece of evidence. If a defendant doesn't give, for example, a notice of alibi in Wisconsin, it is excluded, and that can implicate a defendant's constitutional rights, but that analysis would be subject to harmless error, and we can assess whether the alibi evidence would have been had any effect on the trial had it been introduced. If this court concludes that the error in this case is a trial error and not a structural error, I think a much easier question for it to resolve is whether the error was harmless. Looking at the various factors that we consider when determining whether an error is harmless, I think most importantly, the state's case against the defendant is the primary thing to examine. And here the evidence against the defendant was strong and also very consistent.
And she had no defense at all. Did she put in any witnesses?
No.
No.
Her defense was to put the state to its burden of proof. I would characterize it as that. We have the victim's testimony. He said he had sex with the defendant three times on three consecutive nights behind an elementary school that I believe was across from her house. And that he received a curfew violation ticket on the last night. We have the victim's mother's testimony. She confronted, upon learning that her son had had sex with the defendant, she confronted Nelson by a text message about this information, and we have Nelson's admissions to her. You're going to be mad at me, but yes, I did. She also admitted that it happened three times right before school let out. When the mother confronted Nelson about their previous conversation, Nelson's mother warning Nelson to, or excuse me, the victim's mother warning Nelson to stay away from the victim, she said, "I know there's laws, but he's hot." And there's a subsequent phone conversation between the two of them where, again, she admitted having sex with the victim three times. This phone conversation was overheard by a law enforcement officer who also saw the text messages.
Counsel, what kind of opinion does the court write? You were asked, agree that there was error here, and you said, no, I don't agree there's error, and I don't agree there wasn't error. I say, assuming there's error, we apply a harmless error test, and the state wins. If I understand that's the essence of your argument. If I'm wrong, you will correct me.
That's okay. Our position.
That's our position. So is that the kind of decision that you want the court to write? Assume that here the defendant wants to testify. The defense counsel recommended she not. She insisted that she testify. The trial court held that he did not think there was a voluntary intelligent waiver of her right not to testify. Therefore, the court did not allow her to testify. Would you put those all in and then say, under these facts, assuming that there's error, we find there's no harmless, that there was no prejudicial error? I mean, is that the kind of opinion you foresee?
I think this court could say it's a very difficult determination to make based on the facts that it has before it, whether the court made an error here. And I think this court could say it's much easier for us to resolve this on harmless error, and we do so.
Do you limit it to where the trial court did it on not knowing an intelligent voluntary waiver? Or would this apply if she just took the stand and the court didn't let her testify about anything? Would you have the same case?
I think we would not have the same case.
What do you think would happen if
the defendant got up? Well, I mean, are we assuming that the court did not allow her to say anything because it was all irrelevant?
That's right.
Yes, I think that if the defendant gets on the stand, and I mean, I think certainly if the court concludes and correctly concludes that it's all irrelevant, I think her right to testify has been.
So she had a right to testify. The court used its discretionary authority about evidence, right?
Correct.
And therefore, there's no error, right?
No constitutional right to present.
Totally different case. So we have to assume this case in any opinion we write.
Yes.
The definition in Fulamonte is, in part, whether or not the error affects the framework within which the trial proceeds, rather than simply an error in the trial process itself. So we have to determine whether precluding her from testifying affects the framework within which the trial proceeds. And you do that in part by looking, unless you have cases right on point, by looking at the list of other examples and seeing where it seems to fit. So tell me why, in this case, when she did not testify and there was no defense presented, that it didn't affect the framework within which the trial proceeded.
Because it didn't affect the overall structure of the trial. It's not a biased judge. It's not the denial of a right to a jury trial. It's not the denial of a right to counsel. It's not the denial of a right to represent oneself. Those errors are structural, largely because it's very difficult to even tell what effect they had on the outcome of trial. And I think that's what the Supreme Court's decision in Gonzalez-Lopez really makes clear, that that's really how we determine harmless error. There may be consequences from the failure for her to testify in that she didn't really have much of a defense to put on, but that, I think, goes to whether the error in this case was actually harmless. you can look at the sort of effects that that might have had on her overall defense strategy and still determine if the error is a trial error. It might not be harmless then, depending on the effects that spring from the court's decision, but it still doesn't preclude a harmless error analysis. Unless there are any more questions?
I don't see you or hear any. Mr. O'Neill?
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Velasquez?
Thank you. I just would like to stress that this error was structural. The court focused during the state's presentation of the case on this being a total denial of the right to testify. This isn't a situation where there were evidentiary rulings that limited the defendant's testimony or pretrial motions in limine or alibi defense statutes that weren't complied with that would have precluded testimony. This is something very different, and I think that's why it's structural, because it's not just about the presentation of evidence. This is about whether an outcome can be reliable and the trial process can be said to be a fair one, where a defendant who clearly states, I want to testify, I want my side to be heard, can be denied the opportunity to speak directly to her jury. I think that's very different than the situations in other cases where, again, those are evidentiary rulings that might be assessed from a harmless error analysis, where this is, again, the entire her entire testimony was precluded. Had the defendant said, I want to testify, but no, I'm not going to tell you what the substance of my testimony is going to be, because that's impermissible. Court, you should not be going beyond the colloquy of determining that I understand and I want to testify. That's where the error occurred. And had she not given any information about what the substance of her testimony would be, we would have absolutely nothing to go on. So I think, again, where the error occurs in this preemptive decision to deny her from getting up on the stand shows that this is not amenable to harmless error, because it's not an outcome determinative right. It's just simply her decision to make, much like the right to self-representation. There, it's not outcome determinative. Courts have noted that oftentimes defendants will fare worse on their own, but nonetheless, it's their decision to make. I think the last issue that I'd like to touch on before my time is up is that this error was also not harmless, and the state, I don't think, has met its burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the error in this case is harmless, because it is the state's burden to prove. And we have perhaps some details that would have come out during testimony. The colloquy certainly is not a representation of her entire testimony. Anything would be speculative. We just don't know what she would have said. We don't know where defense attorneys' questioning would have gone. We certainly do know there were at least a couple points of contention, factual points of contention that Ms. Nelson had to make. And I think using her statements against her and her preclusion from really presenting any kind of defense show that even if this court decides harmless error analysis is applicable here, that this error was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Is there anything that she would have said that's in the record that was a denial of the acts of sexual intercourse alleged? Forget about the date, just the acts themselves.
She did not deny having sexual intercourse with the complainant. There was, again, this unbuckling, who unbuckled whose pants, and that goes to a jury instruction. And
it may. I was looking at your saying this error is not harmless.
Right.
And if she didn't or wouldn't have said anything that would have drawn into question whether she actually had intercourse with this boy or not, I don't see how if we get to harmless error, we are going to find that it wasn't harmless.
Well, we don't have her entire testimony, of course, on that issue. So beyond just whether or not they had sexual intercourse, the state would also have to prove that she instructed him or affirmatively consented. And that's something that's
missing. Is consent an issue? I thought the jury was instructed that it wasn't.
So the jury is instructed that in order to find her guilty, and this is the exact jury instruction, and my red light is on, so.
You should answer, Justice Seeker.
Okay. With respect to the act of sexual intercourse, Angelica Nelson must have instructed or directed the complainant to perform an act of sexual intercourse upon her, or Angelica Nelson must have allowed, that is, consciously and affirmatively consented to the complainant performing an act of sexual intercourse on her. And that is testimony perhaps she would have given to that would have been exculpatory. We just simply don't know. Again, I think demonstrating why this is structural error.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Ms. Velasquez. Thank you, Mr. O'Neill, for your arguments. We've had a couple of cases in recent weeks on structural error, which means you don't want the harmless error analysis applied. And thank you for your briefs and your argument. And that concludes our hearing in 2012. 12AB 2140 CR State versus Angelica C. Nelson. The court is in recess until tomorrow when it will hear another three cases, and the court will meet in closed session at 3 o'clock. We are in recess.